I'm very happy to welcome Ben Killam. He is author of the book Out on a Limb, What Black Bears Have Taught Me About Intelligence and Intuition. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Thanks for having me.
So tell us how you started rescuing orphaned black bear cubs.
Well, like everything in life, it almost came by accident. I grew up with my father, Lawrence Killam, who was a virologist at the Dartmouth Medical School, who studied birds as an avocation. So I grew up with lots of wild animals around the house. My dad wrote a book on woodpeckers of the eastern United States, as well as a book on crows and ravens. And when I was 2 years old, he went on sabbatical to Africa and brought a half-grown leopard into the house. Much to my mother's chagrin, my younger sister, Phoebe, was one at the time, and she currently helps me with the black bears. And my next oldest brother, Josh, was four, and he woke up one morning with a leopard at the end of his bed screaming. But needless to say, we all survived and returned from Africa with two African hornbills and a Nile crocodile that my dad raised in a basement shower until it was about 6 feet long. So I grew up with a exposure to lots of wild animals. In 1961, we came up to New Hampshire, and he had a license to keep any wild animal that was brought to him. So we had porcupines and fox and woodpeckers and aviaries and crows and ravens and hawks and owls. And when my time came along, I was interested in carnivores. And carnivores present a bit of a problem to study because for anybody who's had any experience with them, they know that they disappear rapidly into the forest, and you don't get much of a chance to observe them. My dad prided himself with simple apparatus, and he and my mother would sit in front of a woodpecker nest and document courtship and behavior. But for carnivores, I had to have a different plan. And based on my childhood experience, I decided I could take an orphan animal and raise it loose in the forest, acting as a surrogate mother to it, and use that, document its juvenile behavior, and use that information to learn about its adult behavior. I wasn't thinking about black bears, because at the time, there was no rehabilitation of black bears in Vermont or New Hampshire, or most of New England. I was thinking more on the lines of a coyote or a bobcat or a fisher, the large woodland weasel we have around here. But it happened to be black bears that came my way, and they turned out to be the ideal animal to study in this fashion because they have a long juvenile period, and they're very methodical. You can see what they're doing. They're not running and darting around. And so it's worked out very well.
Now, how did the bear cubs that you adopted become orphans in the first place?
Well, they become orphans in lots of different ways. We've raised and rehabilitated and returned to the wild over 100 black bear cubs at this point. Some of them, their mothers are shot at chicken coops that don't have adequate protection, which could be as simple as an electric fence with bait on it, peanut butter or bacon grease rubbed on the wire. Because bears check out all new smells with their tongue, they're easy to manage. But people tend to overreact and just shoot, and then next thing you know, there's a bunch of cubs up a tree, and that's a problem. But mothers get hit by automobiles, and sometimes it's a logging operation that disturbs the den, and the cubs are sent to us. This year we had two cubs that came from a rabbit hunter that happened to shoot the mother, and his dog got after the cubs, so they were injured when they came in. So there's also natural abandonments. If mother bears don't put on enough fat to nurse their cubs through the spring, they'll often separate from the cubs, and the cubs will show up in people's yards, and we get those as well.
Now, you have a special relationship with a female bear named Squirty. Tell us about her and about the long-term connection that you have formed.
Well, Squirty came to me about 18 years ago, and she was a 3-pound cub, and she had two siblings, and their den was disturbed in a logging operation. And Squirty has not only successfully established herself in the wild, but she currently shares a greater home range with daughters and granddaughters. As Squirty gained more land, she would place a daughter in that expanded territory, and her daughters would do the same thing. So currently there's a fairly large area that her family group or clan controls. But I see her on a regular basis, and I can still change her radio collar without sedating her. It costs me a few Oreo cookies to do it each time, but she'll let me do it as long as I pay her.
Because basically she thinks that you're on some level her mother.
Well, she may think that I'm her mother, but she's dominant over me.
Right.
I still am, you know, when I go and interact with her in the wild, I'm taking her time. And if I take too much time, she'll ask me to leave by false charging me or otherwise communicating with me. But the interesting thing is, because I raised her, she treats me like a bear. There is no intimidation between us. And she has rules, and I have to obey her rules. And if I don't, she'll punish me or false charge or bite me to make sure that I understand the importance of it. And then if she bites me, she'll reconcile. She'll go into a soft, repetitive moan saying, "I'm terribly sorry, but that was necessary."
Well, that's one of the things that's so amazing about this book is you write about how bears have a kind of moral code and a judicial system to enforce that code. What does that look like?
Well, it's very similar to our own, and bears, I believe, are reciprocal altruists. They share their resources with strangers, and they do it because no bear or group of bears can control all the resources they need at any given time, unlike truly social animals that have territories with family units living within those territories. And because of this, the closest thing they have to a territory is the female. An adult female has to have 3 to 8 square miles of high-quality home range to raise cubs on because their cubs have short legs. And she's relatively territorial over that area. And these female home ranges are evenly spaced on the landscape. But their food supply, which is the highest quality foods in the forest, the nuts, berries, and ants, bees, and grubs, are generally available in patches and affected by the weather and unevenly dispersed in the landscape. So at any given time, one female bear may have a huge surplus of food in her home range and her immediate neighbor can have nothing. And this has led to a system of sharing over time. But in any system of sharing, there has to be some way of dealing with cheaters. And that's where a judicial system comes in. And bears, wherever they travel, it's transparent. They're leaving scent on wherever their fur touches an object or a leaf or a branch that other bears can follow. So they can follow each other to find food, which they do on a regular basis, and they can follow each other to punish if one bear breaks another bear's rules. And it's a much better judicial system than we have. You know, we have DNA and fingerprinting, but we think that's hot stuff. But we have to get it off the perpetrator. We got to find it at the crime scene, and we've got to find the perpetrator again. And bears know who took their food, and they can track them down and exact punishment at any given time.
Your work has exposed a lot of popular ideas about bears as being really myths that aren't true. For example, what you've just described, bears aren't solitary creatures. They, in fact, have all kinds of communication and complicated social structures.
Yeah, when I started doing this work, bears were thought to be solitary, and that is that the only interactions they had with their own kind was with their offspring and their mates during the mating season, and they knew they congregated at concentrated food sources like salmon rivers or dumps. But other than that, they knew very little about them. And every animal, you know, as simply as we may lay out their social behavior in words, like saying solitary or social, it has to be much more complex than it is. And it's just been a matter of taking the time to make the observations, to assemble all the observations that I found and recognize the system that's taking place. And it's a very elaborate social system. And these bears, on a regular basis, communicate and cooperate with strangers. And that's what makes them so much like ourselves.
We're talking to Ben Killam about his book, Out on a Limb, What Black Bears Have Taught Me About Intelligence and Intuition. Now, it turns out that bears have a sophisticated and varied form of communication that involve visuals and sounds and smells. Tell us about some of the characteristics of bear language that you've observed.
Well, the bear vocalizations are a mix of emotion and intention, and that parallels human language. Our language is an emotional utterance with a mechanical manipulation of our lips, teeth, tongue, and larynx. So we can lie, deceive, or bluff with our words, but if you want to figure out what the truth is, you read our facial expressions and our body language, or you put a polygraph on us. And bears, when they communicate with emotion, they have facial expressions that are very similar to our own, but not as complex, because humans, after all, have the most complex facial expressions of any animal on Earth. But the emotional communication is generally honest. It comes from the central nervous system, and it can be the intensity of a vocalization that determines the mood of the bear at the time. But when they want to communicate with intention, they generate sounds and actions mechanically. So now they chomp their teeth, they huff, they swat, they false charge, they make a guttural sound, which is a ho 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 ho. And the meaning of these sounds and actions are based on the context of the situation at the time. So if you met a female bear while you were out hiking on a hiking trail and her cubs were already up a tree, and she false charged you, that means rushing towards you and expelling a big blast of air that may scare the daylights out of you. She's simply trying to delay confrontation, that is, having you attack her, long enough so communication can take place. But if you were working at a restaurant and you were taking a pail of food scraps out to a dumpster and a bear false charges you, he simply wants you to drop the pail of food scraps before you put it in the dumpster. So it really depends on context, and we as humans we tend to take things literally. We think our language is the only way we communicate. Yet 85% of how we communicate every day is through body language, facial expressions, and intonation of our voice and such.
Bears also communicate, as you've discovered yourself, with a kind of pantomime.
Yeah, the pantomime was terribly interesting. A number of times these bears have, when they felt they weren't communicating to me, or realized they weren't communicating to me, they would act out what their needs were. I remember one time one of my bears, Yoda, who was a cub that I raised, she only lived until she was 5 and a half, but I visited her at her winter den in March one year, and she came up to me, and I brought a food, a little bit of food for her, just thinking she might be hungry, but she went after my gloves and my hat. And I took them back from her because they were valuable to me, and I didn't realize what she was trying to say to me. And then she went over across about 8 feet of snow and raked up 2 beech leaves and symbolically raked them back to her den. And it dawned on me that she needed bedding. And I looked in the den, and the den was all full of snow and ice because the entry was too big, and the snow and ice had blown in. And so the next day I came back and brought her half a bale of hay, and tucked that down in around herself and the 2 newborn cubs. But the fact that she could read my mind and know I wasn't understanding something is an example of theory of mind and much higher cognitive abilities than we would expect from these animals.
Well, this is another thing that's really amazing. And I have to say, each time that I interview people who are animal researchers, yet another question comes up, or another piece of evidence comes up, that human beings aren't as unique or special as we've always thought we were, there are some traits that bears have that we might have thought were unique to humans. Tell us more about some of those.
Well, all of these things, and things like theory of mind and the ability to do mental time travel, to remember the past, apply it to the present, and project into the future. I was with Squirty and one of her mates 1 year, and the first day the mate showed up, when I left to go back to my truck, Squirty followed me. And that happened on a couple successive days. And finally, on the fifth day they were together, I went up in the woods and met him in the woods, and Squirty came down to me, and I offered her a food reward, which I always did to pay for her time, a small bag of dog food that it would take her 35 minutes to eat, but it's the same amount of dog food as if I gave it to my Labrador buddy. He would eat in about a minute and a half. And she came down to my feet, and this big male bear that was about 400 pounds came down and sat 10 feet away. And he would chomp his teeth and lay down, stand up. And then finally he approached her, making a gulp vocalization, which was meant, come on, let's go, let's get out of here. And he came within 4 feet of me, and I got very nervous, and I realized it was probably time I should leave. And I had my video camera, and I filmed the entire encounter. And I waited for him to go back to being 10 feet away. And he laid down and got comfortable, and then I started to back out, intuitively thinking that they'd be happy to see me go. And when I did that, he rushed me, and his head was about 3 feet from me and staring right at me. And Squirty turned around and lunged into him and went, oh, which meant go sit down. And he dutifully backed up and sat down. And I realized that I couldn't get out of there, but I couldn't believe that he didn't want me to go. And so I tried it again, going out another direction, waited for him to lie down and get comfortable again. And again, when I tried it, he rushed me, and again his eyes locked right on mine. And again, Squirty turned and went, oh, told him to go sit down. And then I realized I was there for the duration. And at this point, I realized that here was a male bear not wanting me to go. And the reason was that in the beginning, when I left, Squirty would follow. And he was relating to that time, applying it to the present, thinking that if I left, Squirty would follow me. And he was projecting and reading her mind and anticipating her action. So, you know, here he was demonstrating mental time travel through the whole thing. And Squirty was also showing a reciprocal relationship with me by protecting me.
It must be amazing to be in that experience of being protected by a bear.
Well, it was, and thankfully, you know, I've stopped going out with Squirty and her male friends during the mating season, but I remember I got home that evening and showed the footage to my wife, Debbie, and Debbie said, well, maybe we better get a radio caller for you so we know where to find you ever happens in front of me.
How did you figure out that bears can count?
Well, every night I give Squirty 12 Oreos as a treat, because that's my access to her. I can check her for wounds. I can still touch her with my hands. I can change her radio collar without sedating her. And when I get to 12, she just drops off and walks away. And so I decided one night I was going to short her one. And when I shorted her one, she attempted to come into the truck to find that extra Oreo. And then I produced it for her. And I did this many different ways, and with the smell of Oreos everywhere, so smell wasn't a factor. And I couldn't fool her. She knew exactly whether I had shorted her by one or two, and she knew that it was 12 she was supposed to get. When she got 12, she wouldn't ask for any more. She would just, you know, drop down and walk away from the truck.
We're talking to Ben Killam about his book, Out on a Limb, What Black Bears Have Taught Me About Intelligence and Intuition. Now, you early on were studying wildlife biology, and you decided not to become a research scientist because you have dyslexia, and then you engaged in this decades-long research project outside of academia. What are some of the advantages and disadvantages of not being in that world of credentialed research scientists?
Well, the advantage was I didn't have anybody looking over my shoulders or telling me how I should do things. One of the difficulties of being dyslexic is that it's not just doing the course material in school, it's having to do it somebody else's way. And so school becomes doubly hard for us. And I was never very good at math or statistics and just generally modern science. I didn't really understand why they were doing things the way they were doing them. I like to observe things. My skill was seeing things in detail. I think in pictures, so I can remember what I see really well and in vivid details. And so I didn't understand why you just couldn't go out and observe and make sense of the world around you, why you had to do these elaborate experiments to answer questions or hypotheses and do things quantitatively. And so when I was unsuccessful at going to graduate school, and when I had the opportunity, I decided to. About 20 years ago, I was accepted as an adult student at the Thayer School of Engineering at Dartmouth College, and they had told me that they were much better at dealing with dyslexia, and if I were tested, I would have accommodations that would make it possible for me to go to the engineering school. Well, I got tested, and I found out that I had a IQ in the top 1%, but I read at a third grade level. The lady who tested me, her eyes just got big and said, "Boy, it'll be interesting what happens to you." And I was 40 at the time. And I said, "Well, aren't all Dartmouth students, don't they all have IQs like that?" And she says, "No, none of them." And then they put me in remedial calculus and physics and computer programming, and I proceeded to flunk all the classes. And I understood theory, but I couldn't do equations. With that experience, I realized and just made my mind up. I just said, if I'm that intelligent, why don't I just do things my own way and just forget about trying to conform to society? And I've been successful ever since. So it's worked out very well. The drawbacks of not being credentialed are that when I go to conferences and things like that, people just don't want to listen to you because you haven't done it the right way, and you get a lot of dismissal of your work, even though you know an awful lot more and have seen an awful lot more than the people who are dismissing you.
Well, it's interesting because the way you work seems to be similar to the way Jane Goodall has been working her whole career, and as you discovered, also similar to the way bear researchers in Russia are working. Do these methods of serious outdoor, patient, long-term, quiet observation, do those no longer exist in the American Academy?
Well, they're certainly disappearing. Jane Goodall had an awful time getting started, and you know she was lucky she had Louis Leakey, who had promoted her in the beginning. He decided that she needed a PhD to fight off the criticism, and she was afforded a PhD based on her observations. It took about she just had to write a thesis at Oxford, and that's. Currently what I'm doing at Drexel University, I'm a PhD candidate now, but they've also been very accommodating. It's the whole PhD program is about teaching me to write a scientific paper, so I can publish in scientific journals what I've already discovered. But no, the true naturalist is pretty much gone, and it's really unfortunate because you can find and learn an awful lot by spending years on studying a single subject, much more than you can by simply spending 1 or 2 years doing a quantitative study. You get a much better understanding, and you find out there's lots of questions to pursue. I mean, I have a life, a long list of things I want to pursue and just may never have the time to pursue.
Well, one thing that you have done is you've gotten together with Chinese panda scientists who are trying to reintroduce pandas into the wild. What has that relationship been like? You've gone there, and they've also come to you.
Yes, it's slow putting together a project in China, and I work with a lot of different people, but we're progressing. I'm going to be returning to China on March 22nd for 2 weeks and probably throughout the summer. But it's going to be a very interesting to do the comparative study between the black bear and the panda. Panda lacks the organ that I discovered, and it's a much more primitive bear. But working in a foreign land and with a lot more people involved, nobody paid much attention to the work I did with black bears. Nobody worried about them because there were so many of them. But the pandas, there's only 1,600 left in the world, and they're an icon in China and of national importance. And so everything's much more controlled and regulated, and you got to move at a much slower pace. But the first part of our study will be teaching the Chinese scientists how to do the kind of work that I've been doing.
Namely, raise bear cubs and then slowly, over the course of many months, reintroduce them into the wild.
Right, that's the goal.
How is having relationships with wild animals like bears different from having relationships with, for example, intelligent dogs?
Well, the nice thing about intelligent dogs is that they, regardless of how we abuse them, they still love us. They don't come back and bite us or punish us or do anything towards us. But a black bear, if you break its rules, it bites you. And they have minds of their own. They're a very different animal than the dog. Dogs are very intelligent, and I suspect black bears are even more intelligent.
I have to ask you this. Because we live here in bear country, and sometimes, I mean, in New Mexico, when we have a drought, bears are more likely to come down into the city. How can we stay safe, have good relationship with bears, both bears that might come down into the city, and also when we're out walking in bear country?
My advice is to learn more about the behavior of a bear, and that's obviously what I've written about in Out on a Limb. And I give advice: if you meet a bear, a female bear on a trail, and their cubs are already up a tree, and she false charges you, I've already said that she's trying to delay aggression or contact for communication to take place. You want to be able to control your own behavior. You want to stand erect and keep your eyes on the bear and talk softly to her. Let her know that you're dominant but not a threat. You never want to show weakness in these situations because an animal that's fearful of you wants to dominate its fear, and that's true with dogs or people or bears. It's a very similar type of behavior that transcends species. And the bears that come into communities and get food from us get tamed very quickly. That's what a definition of a nuisance bear is, and they get tamed quickly because of their social behavior. They share food naturally, and if you share food with a bear, they think highly of you, and they become friendly much quicker. They read much more into the act of sharing with them than you intend to convey. You're actually entering into a social contract with them. And I've often said it, giving food to a bear is like inviting your brother-in-law over for dinner and he stays for a month. They take a lot more advantage of.
So once you start feeding a bear, then that bear wants you to keep feeding it, and then you've entered into a relationship that you didn't intend to get into.
Right. And if you keep feeding it, ultimately you're going to have the authorities help you get out of the situation because the bears will get either more aggressive or damage property, or they will expect that feeding to continue. But at the same time, the bears that come into communities and get food from people are less aggressive towards people because they think they get, as I say, they get friendly towards them. So you're less likely to get into that situation of a bear false charging you, or where you have to hold your ground and keep your eyes on them and talk softly to them.
Ben Killam is author of the book Out on a Limb, What Black Bears Have Taught Me About Intelligence and Intuition. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. Thanks for having me.